This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. For your Thursday, Sven Sundgaard's going to join us a little bit later on. We'll talk the weather with him. But right now, obviously, the big story so far today is the attempt by the city of Minneapolis to reopen George Floyd Square, 38th in Chicago, the scene where George Floyd was murdered by police officer Derek Chauvin and three others. The win in this morning, and obviously it's been a bit of a stressful day over there. Joining us to talk a little bit about this, Ricardo Lopez is with the Minnesota Reformer. If you're not reading them, that you are wrong. The exceptional journalism over there. He's been covering this story so far today. Ricardo, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, just a quick question on the beginning of this. How much heads up was there from the city that they were going to be in there this morning to take down the barricades that had been erected?
There was actually very little to no notice at all. I mean, I think, you know, the mayor said today during press conference this afternoon that he was obviously aware that it was happening. But I think the intention was to be able to go in, you know, very early, you know, 4:30 a.m., an hour before sunrise, and try to do this, you know, with the least amount of, you know, disruption and pushback as possible.
Okay. And they went in, it sounds like city crews went in and they started, it's kind of hard to understand. It sounds like what they want to do is kind of create a roundabout in the middle where the statue of the fist still stands, but the intersection itself is open, correct?
Correct. I think, you know, what's happening now is that, you know, and I don't know if you were watching the press conference this afternoon, but there were, you know, members from this local group called the Agape Movement, which is a local group that has contracted with the city for things like civic outreach and engagement with South Minneapolis youth. And so, you know, according to one of the co-founders, Steve Floyd, he said that they had approached the city with a plan to, you know, begin this phased reopening of the intersection there. You know, Steve Floyd was speaking about it today and said that, you know, he felt that there was a natural opportunity to do something like this now, especially, you know, since we've had the verdict in the Chauvin trial. But as he put it, you know, what was the impetus for him was this gun violence that we've been seeing an uptick of in Minneapolis that has resulted in the death of some black children here. And so he felt that, you know, reopening the square was important to them. And he, you know, was very careful to say that he wasn't trying to minimize the work done by the caretakers and the women of the square that are, you know, calling their work courageous. But, you know, the intention was to have no police presence in order to, you know, minimize tensions, but Agape would provide, you know, kind of security and help the city crews, you know, in terms of de-escalating any potential tensions there.
I will say this, and some of the reports sound like the community groups involved were not on board with this, and that not even that one group was completely on board with that. Is that correct?
Correct. I mean, I think, you know, what, you know, and they were very sort of open about this part. I mean, I spoke with some of the caretakers and activists at the square who, you know, who were careful not necessarily to, I mean, I think you're seeing some pushback from the Agape members, but, you know, they were still careful to, you know, not necessarily put the brunt of it on them. Because I think there is a lot of division about what should be done there. I mean, I think you've got neighbors there who feel that, you know, it's time for the square to reopen, businesses who have been affected by the closure there. And so everyone is trying to kind of navigate this really thorny, fraught political issue that it's become now, right? It's like, how do you memorialize George Floyd, and how do you meet the demands that activists in the community have had around racial justice?
And one of the things which is kind of very important here is the dynamics of involved here are not simplistic. This is not, I mean, it would be great if we can just say these people want it open, these people want it closed, but it is much more multi-layered than that. You have the people, obviously, who are there, who might not live there, not might have businesses there, but feel an association there because of George Floyd. You have the city who wants to have this open, although I don't know if I personally, on a personal note, don't know if that's necessarily the right idea. But you also have a lot of citizens who live there. These are the residents of that intersection, of that area, who are not on board with that being completely shut down forever. And so this is there's much more of a conflict here. And I think one of the things that is, I think the city is finally responding to is the residents of that area finally pushing back somewhat and saying, no, a year has been long enough. We need to move ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, I think that's exactly, you know, the dynamic you're pointing out is exactly correct. I mean, the city, you know, saying, you know, in some of the communication to the city workers who were dispatched there this morning to begin some of this work, I mean, they were saying that, you know, a lot of the residents, you know, are supporting the efforts to do this, you know, even though there's a group of people who are very, you know, outspoken about what they want to see instead. So, you know, it's kind of tough to navigate. It's also tough to, you know, to say, you know, where the breakdown is exactly, right? Because I think everybody has a lot of different ideas about what needs to be done.
Okay. And we also should mention that one thing that Mayor Fry has said is that definitively the site where George Floyd was killed, no vehicle will ever be on that spot again. How big is, I mean, I've been there. I'm kind of wondering how far out onto Chicago is that coming? Is it going to take out in pretty much an entire lane there in front of the Cup Foods?
Right. So they, you know, city crews erected these kind of stone barricades around that spot there where George Floyd was killed, in front of Cup Foods. And so that artwork in that area there has been preserved. You know, the intention is also to keep that Fisk sculpture in the center of the intersection and direct traffic around it. There was also sort of a protected bike lane that was installed there in front of the gas station. So, you know, if plans like this continue moving forward, I mean, you'll see sort of a diminished presence of cars, but you'll still see, you know, vehicle traffic there being able to go through the intersection.
And of course, as to expect, by the way, Ricardo Lopez joining us right now, a Minnesota reformer, talking about the attempt to reopen up George Floyd Square. And not a surprise, immediately some of the people that want that square closed started re-erecting barricades. I'm concerned, to say the least. I think a lot of people are about where that might be heading. But it didn't sound it didn't sound like they were really necessarily fortifications by any means. It was like plywood, and they're trying to basically stop a flood with a thimble. Is that wrong, or is there more of an organized attempt to reshut down the square than I'm seeing at this point?
I think, you know, the barricade kind of went up almost immediately as soon as the workers left. I mean, I don't think there's any intention right now to stop that, or, you know, to allow traffic to resume. And I think that's something that Mayor Fry, you know, spoke about. You know, I asked him, you know, activists are pretty determined that they're not going to leave that square right now, and are going to resist any of those efforts. So what about the potential for clashes? Like, what's the city trying to do here? And so he was very vague. I think, you know, I think his vagueness sort of speaks to the difficulty he has, because, you know, he's trying to avoid a situation where the police have to go in and have any potential clash with people who are there. I think, you know, he's very cognizant of that. But whether that'll be successful, who knows? I mean, I think, you know, we've seen the reopening of this intersection push back. You know, I think there were initially talks to potentially do it last summer, but we've kind of been in this holding pattern for several months.
I'm going to ask a question. I mean, you've been around the activists, I think, more than I have. At least you've seen them, I think, more on the front lines as a journalist.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
How are they? Are they going to accept this? I mean, that's the legit question. Is that? I mean, there are people, once again, that they don't live there, they don't have businesses there, but they feel that bond. And I'm not going to diminish that bond. Obviously, it's a very legitimate bond for what happened in that intersection. But will the protesters, who might not have a connection to that immediate area, will they accept the idea of that even reopening again?
You know, I think for some, obviously, that will never be, you know, the case for them. I think, you know, there was just such a long list of demands that were released, you know, by the group Meet on the Streets about what they wanted to see happen in terms of, you know, what, you know, things like, you know, recalling Mike Freeman, having certain law enforcement officials also fired, having inquiries opened into other black men who have been killed or accused, in the criminal justice system, having their cases sort of taken another look at. So, I mean, it was such a long list of demands, and I think it's something like that would be tough to do, and to sort of speak to that point, Mayor Friday, they said that the city will put its money where its mouth is, and talked about using some of the money that was coming from the COVID-19, federal relief towards investing in that area. He didn't give specifics about that, but I think he's aware that, it's going to have to take more than just preserving the art and memorializing George Floyd. It's going to have to take some type of investment in the community that has long, been calling for it.
Well, and it should be also noted at this point that there's a lot of art that is outside of that, what would be the protected area. Some things there, which, obviously I know there's going to be some effort to try to preserve some of that, but some of that won't be preserved. That's just, this is kind of one of those things where it's whether or not you want to second guess and say they waited too long or they did not wait long enough. It does not seem like there was a comprehensive plan here. And I think that's where the minute one of those pieces of art disappears, people are going to get upset. The minute that all of a sudden that corridor is not open, other people are going to get upset. I just don't see how this is going to get resolved anytime earlier. Is there any, to your knowledge from the city, is there any long-term plan where they could maybe build a bridge over the area, tunnel over the area, shut down the intersection, make it into a park? Is there any other discussions going on about potential futures of the intersection and how they could revisit it, redesign it maybe?
I think at the moment I haven't heard those types of plans. I know council member Andrew Jenkins, who represents the district, spoke about that, during the press conference this afternoon, saying that she is committed to seeing through what needs to happen with a lot of community and input. What that sort of community input looks like, sometimes is open to debate, because I think, a lot of the folks at the square felt like, even though they were in talks with the city about what they wanted to see happen, they felt that ultimately the city decided to move on doing that without, their support. And so I think that really created this feeling feeling like they were not being heard in that regard. But, I think a lot of ideas are on the table, and it's unclear what ultimately will end up happening.
The one last thing, Ricardo Lopez, once again, Minister of Reformer, joining us. One last thing I want to talk about really quick is where this goes tonight. Obviously, there was a story. One of the parks, there was a police there were police in a neighboring park, not necessarily in the square, but in a neighboring park. I'm going to be shocked if there isn't some attempt to reshut down the intersection again tonight, maybe with a little bit more oomph and a little bit more anger. How concerned do you feel as if that area is, the city is, about potential problems in George Floyd Square tonight?
Well, I think, as far as tonight, it's hard to gauge. I mean, I think there was a lot of tension throughout the day. There was a lot of sort of conflict, and members of the Agape group, talked about, their sort of plans for the next few days is to continue being at the block, continue having conversations with people who are there. Because I think that they recognize that it's going to take a lot of, conversations to be able to kind of keep things to a point where they don't escalate. And that was one of the things that Mayor Fry called one of his, paramount goals, which is just to avoid any of those types of clashes. So, I don't think you will necessarily see police or any law enforcement presence, at that intersection unless things get really, take a turn for the worse.
You can't deny, I know you guys have covered this too. You can't deny the fact that some of the businesses over there, they've really suffered because people don't want to go down there. People are afraid to go down there. There's a crime issue down there. And that's one of the things we've talked about too, is that, if you want to be a community policing, well, you still got to police, and it doesn't seem like that element is being taken care of. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think, we've written about some of those challenges there. I mean, obviously, more recently on the anniversary of George Floyd's killing, there was gunfire that erupted nearby that was, very public and things like that. So even if the caretakers, are angry at some of the depictions of the intersection there, I mean, what they say is that it's not dangerous. It's not this vicious place. But nonetheless, for a lot of people, that is the perception of the square. And if that's what's happening, people are going to be resistant to patronizing some of those businesses there.
I hope it goes through. I think I know you guys are the reformer. It'd be great. They open it up. They got the center there. They got the statue. We make it a thing. I think we do a weekly thing out there. I'm all for that. I don't know. I'm concerned. This is my point, though. I want to tell everyone once again, if you are not following the Minnesota Reformer, it is absolutely the best freaking media in this town right now. The writers on that are sensational. The stories are top-notch. Ricardo is part of that, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you on my show. Thank you very much. I appreciate the update on George Floyd Square, my friend.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Take care. Ricardo Lopez joining us, Minnesota Reformer. Make sure you're following them. We'll spotlight that interview. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Love to get your thoughts. What do you think? What do you think should happen here? It's the Matt McNeil Show. We'll take a break right now on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. You know, I have to admit, I'm somewhat, I don't know what to kind of think about. I don't know what kind of to think about the reopening here, because my first thought is my gut feeling is the same thing. It should stay closed. You've got plenty of weird, quirky neighborhoods. For God's sakes, how many streets, you know, are blocked off on the southwest side of Minneapolis? All right. How many where you can't go straight up them because they've tried to make them more residential? So they basically have to curve around and there are blocks which have been turned into parks. There's that one off of Washington Avenue over off on the east side where it's the old original homes, and they've kind of kept it that way, and that's kind of nice. It's very nice. Definitely has got some character. But the question I have comes down to where when you look at the impact, the importance, the meaning of that intersection now. I just don't know how it's such an easy slam dunk to reopen it. You got to do something more than just put some concrete pylons around where George Floyd was killed. You got to do more than that. You have to do more than, the bare minimum, and I don't have any problem saying that. I don't have any problem saying you got to do more than the bare minimum. But this just kind of crossing your fingers and hoping things go well. I do like the idea of the roundabout, and as I talked with Ricardo Lopez, I like the idea of the roundabout with the big fist in the middle of the street. I like that idea, but I think you need more. And more means not just the George Floyd murder scene forever blocked off. I think you need more. Not just saving the artwork. You have an opportunity here. I mean, my God, we just had the Tulsa massacre honored by Biden, recognized one of many massacres that have happened against the African-American community in this country. And we have still daily in this country the death of black people at the hands of law enforcement across the country. And the question then becomes, do we have an opportunity to make something bigger here? Now, I am going to be straightforward. I need to be straightforward. I don't live there. I live in Hopkins. I don't live in Minneapolis. I am smart enough to say that my opinion needs to take a little bit of a lesser importance. It doesn't mean it's not important to me. Doesn't mean I don't believe it. It just means that if I live on 38th in Chicago, that I think you do actually have a little more say in how things should be going in your intersection than some, you know, suburbanite monkey out in Hopkins. So I understand what you're saying. The passion. I do. I really do. That place is very moving. It is very hard. It is very hard to be there. It's very sad. But at the same time, people who are basically don't have, you know, kind of one of those things where it's a connection. You know, it doesn't mean I'm not saying you don't have a connection to the what happened, but I'm saying more the connection to the direct immediate area. You're not a business owner, you're not a landowner, you're a business owner, renter, property owner, whatever the case may be. I think they have to have some say in how that intersection goes. Still, though, I'd sure love to see it shut down. Are we ready for some phone calls? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's take Julie first. Julie is in Minneapolis. Welcome on in, Julie.
I live 10 blocks away. I really don't have a right to an opinion on what should happen. I have a couple of friends that live close to the area, close to the corner of 38th in Chicago. But it's a very complicated, multi-layered situation. Because if we say we want it closed down, we ignore the many people that live very, very close to 38th in Chicago that are living in fear because the criminals feel free, according to multiple articles in the paper and that I've seen on television, the criminals feel very free to enter the square at will, commit crimes, hide in people's yards. And some people feel like they're prisoners of their own homes. And so that's it is multi-layered. I'd love to go to this one little restaurant that's there, but I don't because I'm an older lady and I'm a chicken. Well, but that's not important. But the people that are experiencing more crime because the police aren't there, That's part of the problem.
Well, and Julie,
that I wanted to throw
up. And that's something I brought up with Ricardo Lopez too. And thanks, Julie. I appreciate the phone call. Thank you very much. That's one of the things I brought up too. Is that okay? If you want to do community policing, which is fine, you have to police. And there's a lot of people that like that. We're going to run this ourselves. But then but those guys are criminals and we don't want to really deal with them. We're just basically about recognizing the square. No. You can't have it both ways. You can't demand the responsibility of taking over the intersection, but then refuse to have the responsibility of taking over the intersection. And that is part of the problem is that there's a lot of people when gunshots go off down there, just shrug their shoulders and say, well, it's a shame, but what are you supposed to do? I don't know. Who are the people that are policing it now? Who are the people that took the job of wanting to police it? And if you say to me, I put up barricades. I shut down the intersection, but I don't want to police it. No. You don't get to do it that way. You can't just go halfway and just say, well, that's all I'm doing. I stop the traffic. That's the only, I'm a traffic cop. That's all I'm doing. I'm not doing the actual cop stuff. That does not help your case that square should have been shut down, is the fact that there was lawlessness at times. Not all the time. But there definitely was some lawlessness down there. And a lot of the people that were supposed to be the community partners that were policing and keeping the place safe could have cared less. And that was part of the problem. Steve and Nora, hold on. I'll get your calls after the break. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So now that the city is trying to reopen up George Floyd Square, where do you stand on it? Where do you stand on it? Like I said, this is a multi-layered, complex issue. There is no easy answers, but I can just, I just don't know if reopening up the square completely is the right one. Nora is in Minneapolis. Let's bring Nora on in. Nora, thanks for holding. Welcome to the show.
Okay, howdy.
Howdy.
I got the idea from someone else that I heard to make buses only on Chicago in that area, but I thought 38th Street would be good to continue going through, but make that little section between around 36th or 37th up to about 40th to where there's no through traffic except buses and cops. Mm-hmm. You can get in there from the side 38th Street or something if you want to park there or go there, but there's no through traffic between 27th and 40th where that park ends. There's a park, really nice park there. So anyway, that's my idea. 38th Street go through and no through traffic on Chicago except buses and cops.
Nora, thank you very much. I appreciate the phone call. That's not a bad idea. Thank you. It's not a bad idea. The problem, and by the way, it should be noted, man, you do it on Nicollet Mall, don't you? You know, you shut it down to, there are multiple places where there are buses only. Do you make it a one-way? I don't know if you do that. I guess that's the question. I mean, if you're going to have to, as much as it's painful, the city does have a say in how they want to do it, but. You know, and if they want, and here's the problem. I have a hard time with this whole, well, it has to go through on Chicago, does it? You got Bloomington, you got Portland, you got Park, you got numerous other major streets that go north-south there. I'm not sure it has to go through on Chicago. But that's not a bad idea. I would not do it four blocks. If it was 30, I'd go 37th to 39th. So two square blocks, buses only, north-south. East-west, maybe reopen up 38th there, east-west. But, that's the kind of compromise that's going to have to happen. Here's the other thing, and let me ask you if you saw this too. When they said they were going to make a roundabout in the center of that intersection, the first thing I said to myself is, how long till some far-right stooge comes running into that intersection in a pickup truck and tries to knock over the statue in the middle of the square? How long? Because I guarantee you, you've seen, belligerent idiot far-right guy come on out, try to vandalize the George Floyd painting, try to tear down, barricades. You see them out there doing it. How long before some guy comes in there, guns his truck and decides to try to run it on over and thinks that, yeah, making a statement for the white man. You know, one of those things, Defending cops. That's what he'll say. I hope not. We are at an interesting intersection here. It looks like we have some justice in the case of Derek Chauvin, that he is going to go to jail, at least, and hoping the judge doesn't take the defense team's motion of just parole or probation. I'm hoping that 30-year sentence is the one that sticks. That will have some teeth to it. You can't just ignore the people that live there anymore. You just can't. And a lot of those people want that intersection reopened again. And they want to have their, some level of normalcy. But the reality is when something like that has happened, the tragedy of that nature has happened, it comes hollowed ground. And even if it's just bus traffic, is that really appropriate for hollow ground? I remember I was out at Gettysburg, and in Gettysburg, and as a matter of fact, one of the things that you'll see at a lot of the Civil War battle sites is, because it's generally prime land, you get encroachment from development. and people who want to open up Walmarts and Sam's Clubs and Targets and McDonald's and all these things, because there's a lot of people that go out there and they want to be there, a store out there. And one of the things which is really interesting is that when it comes to that stuff, there is a very thin margin of tolerance from the Civil War sites themselves that they say, like, no, we're not going to have Walmart logos over the Gettysburg battlefield. That's not going to happen. You're not going to have, a Dairy Queen drive-through right where the Massachusetts artillery lost most of their lives. No, that's just not going to happen. So the question then becomes, what do you do? And in the case of the Civil War sites, they treat them as hallowed ground and they treat them as memorials and they treat them there. Is it that hard to do that with George Floyd Square? Is it really that hard? Like I said, I'm just a guy from Hopkins. You can take my points and dismiss them, and I'm not going to, how can I really argue? I don't live there. But I can say this, I think the city didn't do a very good job. I think the people that are not connected to the area that are protesting there, they're trying to hold the square like it's some sort of autonomous zone. It's not, but it is. I think their heart's in the right place, but unfortunately, I think they bit off more than they can chew, and they cannot police the area and keep the area safe. And the people that live there and work there, some of whom want it shut down, some of them who don't, they should have a say, and as a matter of fact, a lot of say in what happens there. 952-946-6205. Let's move on to the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. As things are once again getting better in regard to this, although I got a story to share from MinnPost coming up here in just a little bit that just is heartbreaking if you want to know the truth. Coronavirus infections have dropped sharply among pre-K-12 students from more than 1,000 per week in April to 369 in the week ending May 22nd, according to the latest weekly pandemic report released on Thursday by the Minnesota Department of Health. The decline matches other signs of progress in Minnesota, where the positivity rate in recent COVID diagnostic testing dropped to 3.1%, the lowest rate on record during the pandemic. Thank you very much, Governor Walz. That's Governor Walz. All those idiots that are out there saying, hey, you don't need to be vaccinated. We don't need to be wearing masks, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that wasn't them. No, that was Governor Walz. Thank you, Governor Walz. I appreciate it. A drop in infections among students is significant because this spring's wave of COVID-19 illnesses in Minnesota was fueled in part by the spread of a virus among children and teenagers who had limited access to vaccine. People 19 and younger made up 16% of known infections in 2020, but 30% of Minnesotans reported infections in May. State Infectious Disease Director Chris Eiserman encouraged people to seek COVID-19 vaccine to further suppress the spread of coronavirus. Minnesota, as of Thursday, 62.4% of all eligible people 12 and older had received at least the first dose of the COVID-19, amounting to 2.9 million people. That's over half the people, folks. Well over half the state now is vaccinated. Nicely done. Just remember that if you're not vaccinated, you're still at risk, Eiserman said, clearly the lower numbers help put the virus certainly seeks out people that are susceptible. I just want to acknowledge that, even though we have a lot to celebrate. Minnesota remains on track to reach the target goal of providing vaccine to 70% of people 16 and older by July 1st. The current rate in that population is 64.7. Hoo-ah. Children 12 to 15 only receive access to the Pfizer version in mid-May. Since then, 80,000 kids in the age range have been receiving shots, exceeding that group, the total of 64,040 recipients among teenagers 16 and 17 who had access to vaccine for a longer period of time. But, 12, 13, 14, 15, that's 4 years versus 2 years. I'm not sure if that's really a comparable number. Health officials remain concerned about the spread of more infectious variants. Even though total infections, COVID-19 hospitalization rates have fallen in Minnesota, the state on Thursday reported another 10 COVID-19 deaths, 238 coronavirus infections, raising Minnesota's totals in the pandemic to 7,437 fatalities, 601,881 infections. I want to make sure I keep, and I know that's a lot of positive news, but we have to take the time to make sure we always highlight 10 people died yesterday. 10 people reported died from coronavirus. Pre this pandemic, if all of a sudden we said 10 people in the state of Minnesota died in one day because of one thing, we would have freaked out. I want to go back to the Ebola freak out of, what was it, 2012 or 2014? And the thought of Ebola had people saying, shut down everything. Shut everything down. What a failure. Obama, horrible. Remember that? I remember that. The thought of that. We got to make sure we always keep in perspective the fact that this has been and still remains. When 10 people are dying per day, that is, those are tragic numbers, people. And once again, I'll be the person to talk about it. The amount of people that have had it, that even though, once again, the amount of people with infections is far out the number of the amount of people who have died, the long-term health consequences are undeniable. Vaccine appears to be protective against the more infectious B117 variant of coronavirus, responsible for roughly 3/4 of new infections in Minnesota, while the state has only identified 217 infections with the B1351 variant first identified in Africa, 306 infections with the P1 variant first identified in Brazil. Health officials have noted they are causing an elevated rate of COVID-19 hospitalizations. These vaccines have shown they have some level of protection against the variants, so that's positive. However, variants do remain. And that's the other thing, too. I mean, I was at the store today. A lot of people not wearing masks. I wore a mask. I'm wearing a mask. Minnesota's had also one of the highest rates of new infections in the U.S. during the latest wave, but its rate of new infections in the past 7 days only ranked 20th among U.S. states. The decline in student infections also is reflected in a decline in sports-related outbreaks, which are defined as two members of the same team suffering infections at the same time with no other transmission sources in common. The state identified 137 such outbreaks in April, but only 65 so far in May. Someone brought up the point. He said the difference is hockey and basketball, the way you play those sports, the sports they're playing right now are baseball, softball. I don't think that's all the sports they're playing. I think there's still some contact. Is lacrosse playing right now? I'm not sure. I don't know. But the nature of the sports that have been, baseball, it's, don't get me wrong, you're the first baseman, you got to hold a guy on first. But pitchers and catchers are not exactly right next to each other. So as long as you're doing, some kind of level of safety protocol or just being careful on the in the dugout, I can see how that drops. The daily testing numbers have fallen sharply over the past month. People should still seek testing if they believe they've been exposed. So there you go on that. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I want to take a break here. There is a story, MinnPost, deaths of despair over the last year. And I'm going to tie this into the coronavirus update because you can't separate this. It is a very sobering story about death in Minnesota due to despair. And I want to talk about it. Greta Call, it's a great story she put on out at MinnPost. We'll take a break right now. Come on back. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Car truck to donate. We have families waiting for a reconditioned vehicle from Auto Technical. Your gift will change their lives. Remember, we recondition the vehicle so you'll receive a much higher tax deduction. 612-919-5526. AutoTechnical.org.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is all digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
Good news, everyone. After a year of challenges, we're getting back on the road. This summer, I'm planning on long overdue road trips heading to the Iron Range and to coastal South Carolina. But before I leave, I'll take my vehicle to Rudy Luther Toyota for service. Most of us have not driven as much as usual, so getting a complete front-to-back inspection at Rudy Luther is just smart. Rudy Luther Toyota's top-notch service team will make sure your car is ready to get back on the road. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. We've talked about the consequences of the pandemic, and not only the pandemic here in Minneapolis, obviously George Floyd and the horrible tragedy that happened there, and the sadness, that the palatable sadness in this town and in this country, in this world, in the last year is undeniable. And we've talked about the consequences, not only of going back to the pandemic and the coronavirus, and we've talked about the fact that the long-term health care, and I'm just reading another story, and guy was sick last April. He is not recovered. Still has a lot of breathing problems. I mean, just unbelievable. And this is going to be a long-term. The health care, the actual health care problems associated with coronavirus are going to be long-standing here for many people. But there's other consequences here, and it's an interesting article, once again, put out by MinnPost. Every year, the Minnesota Department of Health reports the number of deaths due to suicide, alcohol, and drug overdoses. Almost every year, the news is grim. The number of fatalities attributed to deaths by despair have risen steadily over the past 20 years. In 2020, the news was mixed, which might surprise some who are expecting, even predicting, rates of suicide, particularly given the rise of stresses and tensions of the year. But suicides were down when compared to 2019, while drug and alcohol-attributed deaths were up. The numbers aren't a big surprise to experts, however, as they say factors influencing these types of deaths are various and complicated. Minnesota Department of Health produces one chart displaying deaths attributed to alcohol, suicide, and drugs for a reason, said Colin Planalp, the senior research fellow at the University of Minnesota's State Health Access Data Assistance Center. Put together, these causes are often called the deaths of despair. There's a general belief among researchers that one of the factors driving them is that people are increasing levels of despair, are dying by suicide, misusing drugs, and drinking excessively, and that is killing Americans at an increasing rate. Data released last month show the number of deaths due to suicide dropping from 830 in 2019 to 723 in 2020. Meanwhile, the number of drug overdoses went from 792 to 1,008, and from alcohol, it was, deaths rose from 821 to 992. The data is preliminary. They do not yet include all Minnesotans who died outside the state. They are not mutually exclusive, meaning the death could appear in multiple categories. So once again, down a little more than 100 suicides, but drug overdoses are up over 200. And deaths by alcohol are up by well over 170, a little over 170. Stefan Gingrich, a senior epidemiologist with the Minnesota Department of Health Injury and Violence Prevention Section, said it was a huge surprise to see the decrease in suicide numbers by the time the annual data came out, because the department had seen it in the data coming. The trickier question is why the decrease happened. They don't know why the suicide numbers are down, but the numbers mirror trends seen in some other states. It's something they are probably going to be looking into. The drop of suicides between 2019 and 2020 is currently the largest since 2000, but says that the data are finalized. He expects the decrease could be similar. One that appears so far, as far as a pattern, the number of deaths due to suicide among Minnesotans under age 64. For those 65 and older, suicides were up in 2020 compared to 2019. Gingrich says the further analysis of the numbers would help inform future suicide prevention efforts. Suicide deaths are complicated, and the factors, both individual and bigger picture, that drive them aren't fully understood. The research has also been over the map in the effect of big stressful events. It's good news we saw a decline, but the long-term trajectory is still troubling. If the news on suicide deaths in 2020 could be seen as a relative good compared to other years, the numbers on alcohol and drug-related deaths were not, though. but also not particularly surprising to those working in the field. The number of drug overdose deaths has been rising and for decades, in part, though, due to rise in despair, but also because of the types of drugs people are using. Powerful synthetic opiates like fentanyl and often laced with other drugs in amounts unknown to the user, as are cocaine and psychostimulants like methamphetamines, causing a rise in overdoses. Almost everybody today who's buying drugs on the street knows they are buying drugs with fentanyl in them, and they don't know how much will be in there, but how potent it'll be. It really could just be a gamble every time, says Celia Jane, the director of the clinical services at the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation. But Jane says she believes the precipitous rate of drug and alcohol deaths in 2020 may have been due in part to pandemic factors. Alcohol and other fat drugs are often used as coping mechanisms for significant stress, and the stress of the past has been extreme. It's not yet clear how many of the 2020 alcohol-attributed deaths were due to long-term conditions that may have started before the pandemic versus immediate causes, typically meaning alcohol poisoning. But the rise in alcohol sales and the research on the way people are drinking during the pandemic is cause for concern when it comes to drinking behaviors now and likely in the future. And that was one thing we also did talk about, is that alcohol sales skyrocketed during the pandemic. And I don't drink. I stopped drinking years ago. I don't drink, but I can tell you it's, and you do, you know, you live your life. I mean, you know, you're not doing anything. If you're, you know, you're doing things legal, you're, there you go. But if you're just sitting at home down in bottles of booze, that's not good. If you're sitting at home just knocking back bottles of booze, that's not good. That's not me here to be, you know, Johnny judgmental. I'm just making an observation. When it comes to alcohol, she worries pandemic is further normalizing drinking in isolation, which could lead to rise in alcoholic deaths and health conditions due to the future. The bottom line, when it comes to deaths due to suicide, drugs, and alcohol, they are preventable. I would advise anyone that is having suicidal thoughts or feels that they're having trouble with alcohol or drugs to, by all means, get in touch with counselors and people that are there to help. Your problems are real. You're serious. You need to be talked with. We are willing. Many people are out there are willing to talk with you. It is not something to be ashamed of. Talk about it. We can stop suicide. We can stop the drug addiction. We can stop the alcoholism. That being said, this has been, it does not, the stress of that last year, and I talked about this yesterday in regards to the people that kept screaming at the beginning of this, if it was someone else besides Trump, it would have been so much worse. And what's settling in now in America in this post-Trump world is that it couldn't have been. That quite literally, it was the worst it could possibly be. That we picked the absolute, not me, not most of us, but enough people picked the absolute worst human being on the planet to become the president of the United States. And the consequences of that are far more reaching than we want to acknowledge or accept. And this is just another sign of the year of despair that we will basically have to get rid of. We'll take a break, come back now. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Hour two, Sven Sundgaard's going to join us here a little bit later on. We'll talk an update on the weather. Man, it is going to be hot for a while, too. It's good. You know, these are the little times, David, that David producing for us here today. David, it's these little times like this when my son having to mow the lawn because I just got done with a medical crisis. I appreciate that. I bet that looks pretty hot out there, Charlie. 952-946-6205. We need to do a little bit of Kronblotter update in regards to this. And by the way, I'm going to keep the topic from the first hour. I'm going to keep open. The opening of George Floyd Square. I'm hearing from some people that they feel as if Mayor Fry double-crossed them. you know, once again, and I talked to Ricardo Lopez, the community organizations that were there, initially the report says they had an agreement with the city to remove the barricades. And then when all of a sudden everyone started getting upset, everyone, there seems to be a lot of people in those organizations like, well, I don't know, that was them, that was not us. And there seems to be a lot of people pointing fingers, but there does seem to have been some, from the reports I'd seen, some level of coordination with the on-the-ground community groups that were there to reopen the intersection. So if, you know, I understand, I mean, a lot of people are mad at Jacob Fry, and I can understand. I don't think this is necessarily him by himself. And once again, and I'm hearing from other people as well, the fact that, you know, if you're going to do community policing and you're leaving the policing out, you know, how long, I mean, it took a year for the locals basically say, you know what, I'm sorry, I'd rather have the police here trying to stop the crime than basically, you know, people that just, you know, that are there to preserve the George Floyd Square, but don't want anything outside of just preserving George Floyd Square, not, you know, caring for the community that they're in. So I think that that's a bit of a problem, too. But I'm not going to deny, once again, I have been very vocal about the fact that I don't think you should reopen that intersection. But you know, what am I? You know, I guess what we'll do is we'll do the white guy path, which means in 100 years we'll have a real solemn ceremony and shut it down then and say, you know, we should have shut this down 100 years ago. Jeez, I mean, why didn't we do this? Yeah, why didn't we? 952-946-6205. But an update on a few stories that actually were somewhat large, one kind of goofy one. The Trump supporter who struck the photojournalist before the president's Duluth rally last fall has now pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge. Dwayne Waldriff. Now, this was that clown that basically ran away after he attacked the CCO television photographer. He's of Lamberton, Minnesota, entered the plea on account of disorderly conduct in a virtual hearing Friday at the State District Court in Duluth. WCCO-TV photojournalist Diamond Cahoon was recording Waldorf as he confronted a group of protesters during the Trump visit in the Duluth International Airport on September 30th. Footage recorded by another person showed the suspect turning around and knocking the phone out of the reporter's hand. You guys want to be peaceful? Be peaceful. You want to be violent? Come to me and all, Waldriff could be heard saying before throwing the punch. Mind you, he's saying this to a phone. The video ended with the journalist picking up the phone and another Trump supporter approaching him yelling while holding a Trump-Pence sign to block his face. The group then backed off. Waldriff's talk was one of several that drove back and forth along Airport Road where supporters of Democratic nominee Joe Biden staged a counter rally. Hey, by the way, FYI, Dwayne, your guy lost. Joe Biden's the president of the United States. A protester had been seen running alongside the truck holding a sign just prior to the incident. Aside from hand gestures and some expletives exchanged among the groups, there did not appear to be any serious physical altercations, although he did hit the guy. He had identified himself as a member of the media, was recording and video in public space, and not injured in the incident. Duluth Priest reported that Waldriff had left the scene before our officers arrived. Coward, coward, Dwayne. He was identified by the suspect after the TV station and police circulated video of still images. Waldriff, who had, and so once again, he went hiding. He has no apparent criminal history, was charged October 9th, with two misdemeanors with city attorney Rebecca St. George, stating, "We will take all criminal matters very seriously. We'll prosecute them a case accordingly." The second count, fifth degree assault, was dismissed as Waldriff entered the plea agreement Friday. Court records indicate Judge Teresa Neo stayed a 60-day jail sentence in favor of 1 year of unsupervised probation. Waldriff also was ordered to pay a $400 fine, which would be forgiven if he writes a letter of apology. Can I please read Dwayne's letter of apology? I would love to read Dwayne, the guy who beat up a phone and then ran away. I'd love to read Dwayne's apology letter. Or, you know, just knowing that guy, he probably won't do it. He probably just pay the $400 and be done with it. Because, You know, let's face it. You get the idea that that guy has got some reasonable rationalness to him? No, not me. Another story, and this one I'm glad I caught, because this one, and this out of the Pioneer Press, I remember we touched on this when the mistrial happened. I was furious about that. But the Watertown man, he has now been sentenced to 12 and a half years in prison on Wednesday for fatally shooting another driver following the May 2020 traffic crash. Anthony Trifoletti, 25 years old. Remember this guy? He claimed self-defense in the death of 39-year-old Douglas Cornelius Lewis, who was shot after an argument following a minor collision near US 61 and Burns in St. Paul. The first trial in March resulted in a mistrial, but a second jury in April convicted Trifoletti of second-degree unintentional murder. Trifoletti's attorney, Thomas Shiah, asked the judge Wednesday for a light sentence, describing the killing as a case of imperfect self-defense. All right, you can call it imperfect self-defense. I think I might call that murder. Or what was the unintentional murder? However, Ramsey County District Judge Thomas Gilligan Jr. said the state Supreme Court had rejected that notion that a defendant deserves leniency because some of the elements of self-defense were present, which is that is key. You can't just pick and choose. Well, I was a little concerned because it was dark and I really couldn't see the other guy, or I thought his hand was going for something. You can't just do that and use that as self-defense, not in Minnesota. In Texas, yeah. I mean, they'll let you murder anyone down there. Gilligan recalled the trial testimony in which the gun safety instructor said he taught Trifoletti, who had a gun permit, the difference between using lethal force out of fear and doing so when he's in real danger. He made the observation that just because you are afraid doesn't mean you are in danger, Gilligan said, adding that it was abundantly clear that Trifoletti was never in danger. Trifoletti testified he thought Lewis had a gun, which was not the case, which is once again goes back to the, this is why I was so outraged by this. I thought he had a gun because he was a black guy. And he was a black guy. But that's kind of what his, I thought he had a gun. He did not have a gun. The judge also noted that Trifoletti had so many opportunities to leave the crash site to avoid the deadly confrontation. There was no reason for him to stick around, but he did. Sentencing guidelines called for a prison term of 10 to 15 years. After the pre-sentence investigation, the probation office recommended 10 years, citing Trifoletti's sincere remorse after the killing and had his credible explanation that he was afraid of Lewis. Okay, bull crap. Being afraid of a black guy is not a viable option. Dear Lord. He was incredible, actually. He was afraid of Lewis. You had the gun. He didn't have one. God, it's the stuff like that crap. It's the crap like that. And the sincere remorse, you know, that's not sincere remorse. Trying to say, I thought he had a gun, a black guy. I thought he had a gun. I shot him. That doesn't sound like sincere remorse to me. And just because Lewis was black doesn't mean he had the right to be shot. During Wednesday's hearing, with two dozen of Lewis's family members listening from two courtrooms to allow for social distancing, Trifoletti apologized, asked for their forgiveness, saying he'd trade my life for his if he could. Trifoletti, who is white, says his decision to shoot Lewis, who was black, was not made out of prejudice. Okay. Prosecutors in Lewis' family asked for the maximum 15 years. His remorse is only about the consequences he may face, said Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Jake Murphy. The victim's sister, Valerie Lewis, said her brother was funny, kind, loyal, smart, adventurous, a deep thinker, and shy. I know my brother didn't provoke Trifoletti. She asked for a maximum sentence so that Trifoletti can reflect on the murder he committed, but also to reflect on his life because something went wrong. Another sister, Alexandria Gaston Atwater, said Dougie Lewis was an amazing man who helped whenever he was needed. They spent almost every day together. She said Trifoletti took a half of me away. Lewis left four children, three of whom are under 18, said Brandon Vaughn, a civil attorney who will represent the family in the forthcoming lawsuit against Trifoletti. He said the family is disappointed with the sentence. Yeah, and it's 12 and a half years. They wanted 15. I think the maximum would have been called for here. Because you've got to remind yourself, once again, this entire argument was, oh, it was self-defense, it was self-defense. And even his own self-defense trainer said there was nothing there. And once again, the argument is, black guy must have a gun. That cannot be an excuse to shoot someone. And even a argument you're trying to make that, oh, well, it wasn't that bad. But how about, I will say on one positive side, how about the fact the guy is going to jail? I was concerned about that one. I have to admit, I was concerned a little bit about that one. 952-946-6205. Finally, on the crime roundup, the St. Paul man charged with misdemeanor theft and disorderly conduct after live streaming himself pretending he wanted to get a vaccine, then grabbing the vials of the COVID-19 vaccine, spiriting them off to be tested because he believed they contained poison. Thomas Humphrey, 32, was the subject of a May 8th reformer story posted on Facebook Live videos of himself walking into an Allina Health vaccination site in Oakdale on May 4th, taking the vial of Pfizer vaccine from a worker, warning others it was poison. The next day, he live-streamed himself taking a vial of Johnson & Johnson vaccine from a CVS worker, again telling customers it was poison. Humphrey is just an extreme example of the nationwide anti-vaccine movement with tentacles in elite media like Fox News and the campaign for Minnesota Republican Governor Scott Jensen. According to the survey data, millions of Americans have absorbed the misinformation about vaccines and now amplifying it through their social media accounts, giving the virus a lifeline even as widespread vaccination has begun to suffocate the disease. Oakdale Police Captain Nick Newton said Allina employees called the Oakdale Police after Humphrey left, according to the citation. Allina nurses were disturbed by the incident, with one of them leaving for the rest of the day. Patients requested aloud whether he had a weapon. Humphreys has gone by the time police arrived, but after reviewing his numerous social media posts about his capers, police mailed citations to the last known address in St. Paul. He will be arrested if he fails to appear in court and charges. He posted stuff on social media that didn't help, said Newton. That's in the no duh category. Humphrey filmed the entire alleged crime from start to finish. You know, these criminals today, they have become the Batman villains. Let me tell you what my entire plan's going to be. It doesn't work that way. You know, you don't have to say a thing, but because you're looking for the fame. He walked in the vaccination site, went through the process until it was time to get a shot. He asked to see the vaccine, swiped it from the worker. Was he a swiper? Took off his mask and said, "That's what we're poisoning everybody with." The worker followed him to the door, telling him there's multiple doses of the vial. "That's how you take your vaccine, guys," said in the video, encouraging his Facebook followers to do the same. "We're putting an end to this, blank." His videos racked up thousands of views of supportive, a lot from the police, by the way. Thank you. And it makes it easier. You date those things, you keep them in file. The police are real appreciative when you keep your crimes cataloged like that. That's some good management right there. He was arrested in Blaine after the vaccine theft, but the officers were unaware that he was called when they were called to the quick shop where he had filmed himself taking all the free sugar packets to draw some sort of analogy of stealing the free vaccine. He was arrested in real. I get an injury. The Quick Trip's not going to be too happy with you taking all the sugar. I'm just going to let you know either. I don't know if they can arrest you for that, but that's not a mulligan, okay? He was arrested, released hours later because he didn't have the valid driver's license plate. His live stream videos indicate he's a member of the Sovereign Citizens, anti-government extremist group that believes they're sovereign from the U.S. Now you're sovereign from freaking reality. That's what you are. You know, I don't know how to say this, but the people of the state of Minnesota are getting vaccinated. We're up into the 60% now. 62 just on the 12 and older, and what, 65 on 16 and older? We're getting there. And guess what's happening? Coronavirus is going away. So it kind of looks like you're complete and total idiots. It does, doesn't it? You're complete and total morons. Seriously, Stupid people. I mean, unbelievably stupid. But hey, I guess the sun might not set tonight, huh? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Crime Roundup. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. You know, I've just, seriously, ever since this morning, I woke up and I saw that they were opening up George Floyd Square. I'm like, oh, man. We need to work together on this. We need to work together. And part of, I think, what's going on, and I think some of the stories we heard earlier about the influencers in regards to, you know, selling certain points with the police reform stuff. I still think the police need to, I think police, once again, police have a role and function within our society. They do. Hint, spoiler alert, it's not killing people, but it is policing. We need to have that. But right now, the Minneapolis Police Department just feels like, the entire thing just feels like they are so determined to win this game. And win this game any way they can. If they have to get political and kind of infiltrate the mayor's office and the city council, they'll do it. But I really think that if you had a group of people sat down, the locals who live down 30th in Chicago, the activists that want to basically make sure George Floyd's memory is preserved, and the city, which does have a right there, because we want to know the truth. As much as you don't like it, that is a city street. They've got to maintain this. This is, people live there. There is a lot of things that are going on. You can't just shrug your shoulders. You just can't. But if you sat down and you said, okay, what are our solution options here? I think we would find one. Unfortunately, the police, they've got their own agenda. The ACLU of Minnesota is suing the city of Minneapolis, the chief of Minneapolis Police Department, alleging the department's disciplinary practices violate Minnesota's public records law. The suit filed on Thursday alleges the department intentionally and incorrectly refers police officers accused of serious violations to coaching, which involves training or meeting with superior to keep records of the incident out of public view. Under Minnesota law, records of complaints against police officers are only public in cases that result in discipline. The city of Minneapolis contends that coaching is not discipline and the records are not public. The lawsuit stems from a records request by the Government Transparency Organization, Minnesota Coalition of Government Information, in February, according to the suit. The organization asked the city for data related to coaching, including coaching for Derek Chauvin, the former officer convicted of murdering George Floyd. The city employee denied the request, according to the lawsuit. More than 70% of complaints against police and result in discipline are referred to coaching, according to the ACLU. I got news for you. Can I say this? With Chauvin, you guys, that's not the hill you want to stand on, guys. You need to release what kind of coaching you gave him. And the only reason I think you guys aren't releasing what kind of coaching you gave him is because you didn't give him any coaching. You basically swept this under the rug. There is a clear disconnect between official statements of transparency and accountability in the Minneapolis Police Department policies that intentionally hide public data. The city and Minneapolis Police Department are ignoring the intent of the letter of the law to deliberately hide bad police behavior, said Coalition on Government Information Board member Paul Ostro. Public information is a civil right. Police reform cannot secede when officer misconduct is hidden from the public, which is basically the Bob Kroll standard. I mean, it just, sweep everything under the rug. The city says coaching is only used for minor violations like speeding, but records show coaching has been used for allegations involving excessive force, failure to provide protective protection, discrimination, and police retaliation and harassment. The lawsuit says the court asked the court to order the city to release the data and damages in the amount determined at the trial. Well, you know, if it's for minor, if it's for speeding, if it's for not filling out your ticket book correctly, yeah, okay, fine, coaching. But when you're looking at it being used for excessive force, that's not a coaching thing, dude. And that's not a coaching. If I'm in a workplace, let's say here, I take Patrick. Patrick, how you doing? All right, I'm going to take you in. I'm just going to start excessive forcing on you, okay? All right? Do you think I am going to get a coaching lesson or fired? What do you think?
I'm going to go with fired.
I'm on the fired side, although we can try it. I mean, we got a break coming up here. I think we got, 3 minutes? We'll see how it goes. Good luck. If Patrick's still here by the time we come back, you know what happened. But that's the deal. I mean, if it's excessive force, if it's discrimination, you know, which is another one. If I start discriminating against you, is my employer going to say, you know what, you need some coaching? Like you're a tennis player? Or are they going to say, oh, there's the door? It's clear you guys in the Minneapolis police are using coaching to hide your criminal activity. Well, I shouldn't say criminal activity, but unacceptable behavior and sometimes criminal activity. And the more you keep denying, the more you keep stopping, and especially if I can make one bit of advice, I would release all the coaching notes you got on Derek Chauvin, because frankly, that's not the guy you should be sitting and defending at this point and making sure his record stays clean, because, spoiler alert, he murdered a man and he's been convicted, and I'm hoping he goes to jail for 30 years and then there are the federal charges. So if that's the hill you want to die on, well, you are really, really dumb. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We will change pace. Sven Sundgaard will join us. Weather time. When we do return on a Thursday, it is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. Sven Sundgaard is going to join us. He's driving right now. So is he trying to drive away from the sun at this point? Good luck with that. Head north. All my best. We'll check with him hopefully just in a few minutes. One thing I wanted to kind of, there was another thing that crossed my mind this morning when I saw them lifting the barricades over at George Floyd Square. Is that if you wanted to look at one moment which basically solidified the idea that that intersection had to be opened up, it was the day, the anniversary of George Floyd's death, and that shooting incident that was broadcast via media, as basically people caught the law, you know, what was the lawlessness of that intersection. And I will not forget one of the community people sort of saying, when someone asked them afterwards about that, and they said, "Well, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to try to stop that? I mean, we can't." And that was when I sort of said, that was basically all the admission you needed at that point, that they couldn't do what they wanted to do down there, which was to keep that area safe. They were looking to keep the area safe, but not the residents, not the businesses. And that is a huge, you know, if you're going to take that kind of responsibility, you got to take all the responsibility. You can't just wash your hands of the unfortunate parts. And I, you know, that was the moment. And I think that was the moment when it became clear that it wasn't going to be much longer at that point. Yeah, we might still have time for a call or two. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Sven Sundgaard is the weatherman extraordinaire for bringmethenews.com. If you're not following his YouTube page, I highly encourage it, especially since we got a treat this week. We're getting a weather forecast every day, which I'm enjoying greatly. Sven Sundgaard, kind enough to join us right now. Hey, Sven.
Well, it just so happens that this week, because of the holiday and the fact that I'm at the cabin for the heat, I did my normal days scrunched them together Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So don't expect it every day all the time now.
Oh, man, you are the best. I absolutely love your weather forecasts. They are fantastic. I'll post today's.
Although it will be happening fairly soon because I'm going to launch some subscription content on Patreon and Facebook, and then I'll be doing them every weekday.
Oh, let me.
But then you're going to have to pay $4.99 a month to watch all of them.
Worth it. Worth it. And when you do that, let me know. We'll make sure we promote that, okay?
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
No problem. Because it is. It's nice to have a good weather guy. I love a good weather guy. I want to start out, actually, though.
It's less than Netflix.
It is.
I think.
Well,
I'm not sure.
And frankly, a better content. I mean, Army of the Dead, what was that? Okay, so I want to start actually off with, and I know you talk more about the weather in regards to just kind of the forecast here, but I want to get into the ag stuff a little bit because I saw a good report from one of the Brownsfield Ag News. They said Minnesota is pretty much mostly planted, but they said that cold spell we had might have actually damaged some of the crops, especially was in southeastern parts of Minnesota where it got really cold. I don't know if you're aware of any of that stuff, but God, the complexities of farming in Minnesota.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what a job, right? I mean, farming is not easy, I don't think, anywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, this state especially, if it's not floods or droughts, it's a early or late frost, or, you know, the fields can be too wet in the spring. We've had that happen a lot. I'm not completely in tune with crops specifically, but I know that, the frost, that was... Isn't it insane to think that was just a week ago? Not even. You know, here we have our first 90-degree day today, but 5 days ago there was frost in parts of western Wisconsin, southeastern Minnesota, literally just north of the metro. I mean, the metro was mostly in the upper 30s, but you didn't have to go far, just like Princeton, Cambridge. They were right near freezing, and then parts of western Wisconsin. So, yeah, I mean, if you have delicate crops. I know driving around last weekend and today, there's corn in the ground and it's sprouting and it's, you know, it's in that delicate phase, and none of the places that I've seen recently have had frost damage, but you know, there are pockets. You can imagine, like, southeastern Minnesota, western Wisconsin, the topography does play into that because the cool air kind of funnels down the hills into these valleys, so you get sort of that mini mountain valley effect that most of us never really experience. But of course, southeastern Minnesota is one of our most rugged parts of the state.
Well, and I was in Carver County. They're all looking good down there. It's good. I mean, it's now we get the heat here. And to a point, too, and you talk about this with plants and animals, the fact that there are plants and animals that can kind of sustain this cool one day and a week later, I mean, roasting hot. It is truly kind of amazing. But, I mean, we're now getting into that heat that you've been promising about.
Yeah, I mean, it's really worth stopping and thinking about just how hardy our native plants and animal species are. I was just talking about this today with my students, my middle schoolers today, showing the average range. When you look at the historical average, the coldest night of the year on average, I mean, it used to be, it's warmer now, 22 below, warmest day of the year on average, 97 degrees. 119 degree spread is normal in a year.
Wow.
And of course, this last week, indicative of how much of a spread we can have, even in just a several day period of 60 degrees, which is just nuts. But yeah, the heat is here. And you know, it's remarkable. I mean, it's not remarkable to hit 90 on June 3rd. In fact, this is about the average date of the first 90 is in the first few days of June when you look at it historically. But what's unique about this heat to watch is the number of 90 degree days we'll see this early. You know, we're talking about, it's possible that we could have consecutive 90s here over the next week of each of the next 7 days, at least five of them. And to have that many before June 10th, that's very unusual.
Well, and your weather forecast today talked about one of the changes with climate changes. 90s are not, we actually are seeing fewer 90-degree temperatures. Is that correct?
Yeah, so, I was breaking out kind of each day this week different parts of climate change elements with regard to summer. It is happy meteorological summer, by the way, because we use even months, started on June 1st. And summer, just like every time of the year, is warming in Minnesota, like other places. But the north central part of the U.S. is one of the slowest warming when it comes to summer. We're the fastest warming in the winter, but slowest warming in the summer. Our summer temperatures are warming just about 2.5 degrees from the historical average, compared to about double that in the winter. and it's our overnights that are really warming. That's what's pushing the warming in the summer. So if you look at high temperatures, it's pretty much flatlined from the historical averages, but it's the overnight, and that's exactly what you'd expect in a greenhouse effect. It traps in the heat. That's how the greenhouse works, and that's also our fastest warming period of the day is nights of the winter, but it's also day and night in the winter. But yeah, the interesting thing, if you don't like the heat, is we're actually seeing three fewer 90-degree days in the summer now compared to historically. So the historical average is about 13. We're about 10 on average, and that's significant. And my theory is that it's because of that increase in precipitation we've been talking about, more torrential downpours and more of them, and that leads to more cloud debris and more humidity, which does keep the temperatures down. We even notice that our higher temperatures don't happen the more humid it gets. We think of hot, humid days as being kind of one and the same together, but actually our hottest days are usually when the air is drier. That's when we reach those upper 90s or even 100. It's very rare we hit 100 degrees with a dew point above 60.
Mm. It seems to me, when you talk about those 90-degree days, where I notice it is around State Fair time, because I remember for years you'd go to State Fair and there's always be one just roaster of a day. We really haven't had one of those in a while.
Yeah, no, we haven't. In fact, if anything, in the last several years, I remember a couple of state fairs where it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, there was a day where I think we barely hit 60. You know, of course, for the fair, if it's dry, that's actually great weather because you're moving around and eating greasy food. And I don't know, the heat just makes that all the more disgusting. But, you know, that's one of the things I'm going to break down when I launch this content, which is going to be soon. I'm going to break down a summer forecast. People probably heard, oh, it's going to be hot, dry summer. I concur, but I go into more detail, and I look at, actually, it would surprise even me, when you look at the data over since 1873, there are trends in the summer. There are periods of the summer that are hotter or drier when you look at the historical average, which kind of surprised me, because I get people email me all the time or messaging me, hey, I'm planning a wedding or, you know, whatever, which weekend is better? And I always kind of rolled my eyes and like, you know, good luck. But actually, there are historically better periods of the summer. And so I break down a little bit more of that as well, you know, because people always seem to think, oh, it always gets hot for the state fair. Well, does it or doesn't it? You know, I'll take a look at that.
You'd mentioned the humidity. That's one of the keys that you pointed out in this, with this current, this at least the beginning part of this heat wave, is the humidity levels are just not there right now, correct?
No, dew point's 52 right now. At one point when we were at 90, an hour or two ago it was 49, so it's a dry heat. So it's not bad, right, at all. We're just not used to the heat yet. But, yeah, and that's part of why we were able to soar to 90 today. What are the thermodynamic model that I created in college and still use for forecasting high temperatures based on the weather balloon data from this morning gave us a maximum high of 86. But that is not taking into account wind, dry air, all those kinds of things. So we outperformed today is what we would say, the computer models or any model, to hit 90, even if as brief as it was. So yeah, the drier air just, it heats up faster, cools down faster as well. Think of the desert where it gets super hot and then it's chilly at night. That's the same effect as dry air here in the summer, and especially we see it in spring and fall. But you know, as that humidity increases over the weekend, you're going to notice a less of a change between morning and afternoon. It'll be hot and uncomfortable, but instead of being in the 60s like it was this morning, it'll be in the 70s, and those high temperatures will be more like around 90 early next week instead of the mid to even upper 90s that some of us could see here on Saturday. But, you know, the heat index, of course, makes up for it when you add the humidity.
I've visited Arizona. No, not for $1 million. I'm not living.
No, 110 degrees is still 110 degrees.
And they'll look at you with a straight face and say, but it's a dry heat. Oh, shut up.
Yeah. Well, and I found out the hard way. My sister went to ASU for one semester her freshman year because she wanted to get the heck out of Minnesota, you know, newly 18. But then found out of state tuition wasn't worth it. But anyway, so we were moving her in August, and they get the monsoon season there. So then it's hot, and they get humidity. Oh my gosh. There's nothing more uncomfortable than Phoenix in August. That's when they get their rainfall. They get those thunderstorms and those haboobs, those dust storms. But it can be hot and humid, and that's just unbearable.
They like to do a lot of bragging come January, December, January, but you don't hear a lot from Arizona or Florida come July and August. They're pretty quiet for those months.
It's just too hot for too long, and that's what I say. You know, I love this weather, but I always tell people, I'm like, if it were like this for as long as it is in Houston or Phoenix or Miami, yeah, then I wouldn't like it. But, you know, we get breaks. Even this heat wave, it'll be a week, and then we'll get a break before anything else happens again. But we do have some records in jeopardy.
Okay.
Saturday, the record high is 92, set back in 1925. I think we're going to fairly easily break that. Tomorrow and Sunday's weather records seem a little more secure, but with how much it heated up today, you know, all bets are off. We could get close. 97 is the record on Sunday. That one seems a little out of reach. But tomorrow's is 96. And the fact that we outperformed any of the computer models today by a good 3-4 degrees, it could be in reach tomorrow, too.
Now, you're up at the cabin. I want to bring this point up as well. It does look like there was some concern about dry air burn conditions. What's the status? Is that northern Minnesota right now and kind of the towards the Dakotas?
It's really statewide tomorrow, because we're going to have the problem that we had a little bit of today, though humidity levels might even be lower tomorrow and temperatures will be higher. So it's this problem of the humidity is not here yet, but the heat is. So with temperatures in the low to mid 90s tomorrow, but dew points that'll maybe be in the low 50s like today, but maybe even lower, add a little more wind. It's going to be dry, windy, and hot. And of course, that all combined with the strongest sun of the year. Even though things have greened up, you know, it would be a different scenario if this were April or early May. But anything, you know, a fire in those conditions can spread rapidly. So that's why it's a bit of a concern. So there is really a fire weather threat pretty much statewide tomorrow. But that does diminish over the weekend as the humidity levels increase.
Well, and on the northern side of the state there, I mean, obviously we talked about those temperature differences. The fact that it was so cool up there not that long ago, does that aid in the fire? I mean, the fact that maybe the cold weather kept that green down a little bit in the northern tier?
Yeah, you know, it is interesting to look at that because, well, it got cold here at a time that kind of slammed on the brakes of greening things up too early that might have killed it when it got cold. You know, there, you know, of course, it doesn't matter how warm it is. Nothing is going to start sprouting in mid to late April, but the mid-May cool down could have delayed things more. And yeah, that could lead to maybe a bit more of a fire danger than they might normally have at this point in the season. But as we've seen also, plants can catch up pretty quickly when given the chance.
Mm-hmm. Where are you at? It sounds delightful. The birds are amazing right
now.
Can
you hear the birds?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know. that's what, you know, you're, producer called me just as when I was still 2 minutes out, and I have the top down on the Jeep. I know it sounds wonderful. If anybody's still at work or anything, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, just give me a couple minutes. I'm almost there. And yeah, a nice south breeze off of the lake. I can't tell you. It's undisclosed location. No, it's north of St. Croix Falls.
Okay.
It's actually my dad's place, but we all use it as a cabin. It's perfect. I don't have to cut the grass. I just come when it's hot.
That's the best kind of place. All right, so we'll run this once again here. Drier 90s basically starting today and running for how many more days?
At least through Monday or Tuesday. You know, if we can get some thunderstorms to develop early next week, you know, you get some of the clouds, that could be enough to keep the temperature down. But we're talking about an air mass that's so hot that even if it's not sunny, 90 degrees is easily achievable. So, you know, if you don't like the heat, hunker down for the potential for a week straight of near 90 degree temperatures. And speaking of the dry weather we're talking about, if we don't get that rain by Tuesday, it's going to get really dry around here pretty quickly with that heat and that intense sun. So right now it keeps kind of pushing further out. The models, it was looking like maybe Monday, Tuesday. Now it may not be till Wednesday or Thursday. Other than that, there is a chance Sunday night, a weak front comes through that's not going to cool us off, but it could be the focus of a few thunderstorms. But yeah, mostly just hot, and then we'll be looking for rain by next week.
Well, and that's why I like when they do get those rainstorms after a while, because those are really intense and kind of cool. So maybe, hopefully not before too long, but enjoy the heat while you can. Enjoy your cabin, and by all means, Sven, when you do launch this Patreon, let's make sure everyone knows about it here, okay?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm about to crack a cold beer, too. It's a nice way to keep it keep cool around here.
We've been drinking all show. So,
good.
Sven, make sure you follow him on YouTube, and I'll make sure I post the bringingthenews.com weather forecast as well. Sven Sundgaard joining us on a Thursday. Have a fantastic weekend. We'll talk to you next week, okay?
You too. Stay cool.
Take care. Sven Sundgaard, kind enough to join us. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. I will say this. Okay, so here's why. My grandmother, God bless her heart, passed away a few years ago. Passed like 20 years ago. My mom's mom. She was down in Arizona, Sun City, Arizona. And I went down to visit. And I believe it was late May. And I walk out of the airport there, Sky Harbor in Phoenix, and I'm just hit in the face with that 100. It's 8 o'clock at night, and here comes it's 112, and it's and my uncle is there driving basically a lava car because I try to touch it, It's like touching a stove. And he picks me up and is like, oh, it's a dry heat. I'm like, okay, you broken people. And my grandma, I go over to my grandma's house. And of course, this is a woman who spent most of her time, she's in Michigan. My grandfather, who also passed away a while back, Detroit. He was working in Detroit. He worked in the auto industry. He did the old school thing. He did the full career, did the retirement. They gave him the gold watch, big party, that sort of thing. So he lived in Detroit area. They had a place up there, but then they decided, and they became instantly acclimated to the lava of the sun that is Arizona. So I get there, and of course, if you're a Minnesotan and you're going to go visit someone in a warmer climate, there is nothing more frustrating than walking into the 85-degree air-conditioned house, because that ain't helping. Nope, you got your AC set at 85. What is wrong with you people? That is not AC. That's rotisserie. So I go in. My grandmother has made a room for me. And she has not two, three wool blankets in case I want to start my own sweat lodge, I don't quite know. And she's like, do you need another blanket? And I'm like, no, Grandma, I'm fine. I'm basically lying naked on the tile floor trying to cool down at all. And she's like, well, I can get a fire started. Oh, no, I'm good. Godforsaken state. What are you people thinking? What were you thinking? It was at that moment I said to myself, I just don't know if I'm cut out for desert weather. I think I like trees that look like trees, not like, Japanese anime pokey art. I like normalcy. I don't get a great thrill about, look at how nice the rocks in the yard look. I don't say, hey, look, another coyote. No, I don't need that. It was also funny because my grandmother, I said to her, well, why don't we go out and get some good food? I hear Phoenix has got some good food. And of course, we're in Sun City. And if you've been to Sun City, if you've been to one in the retirement community, you know where this is going. She says, well, I know this place. It has the best pasta. It's guys from New York. It's the best. I'm like, hey, pasta? I can do pasta. New York pasta? Sure, let's go do this. It was atrocious. It was basically a can of Hunt's sauce on top of overboiled noodles. But for them, it was like, oh, this is the most flavorful thing I've ever had. So the next day I said to her, well, we're in the desert Southwest. Take me to some good Southwestern cuisine. She took me to McDonald's. It took me to McDonald's. It wasn't even Southwest. And that Big Mac sure has a flair to it. I have not gone back. I know there are some lovely areas. There are some nice restaurants. And I know I was somewhat kind of stuck with Grandma at that point. But I'll take Minnesota. What Sven described on the lake, south wind, got a beer in the hand. I hope you have that going for you. I hope you have a good weekend on that. Native Roots Radio, they are up next day with us. We are back on a Friday. Thank you very much for being here. Thanks to David. Thanks to Patrick. Thanks to Brett. And thank you. Till tomorrow. See ya.